Welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So get yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. T.S. Eliot, Little Gidding. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about art, beauty, and music. I'm your host, Joy, and I'm thrilled to have you back. So that little excerpt is from a beautiful poem by T.S. Eliot called Little Gidding, and it's something that I think about most times when I return home, which is something I'm thinking about a lot lately because I'm headed back to the United States in less than a week. I'm just so excited to go back and hug my Darcy dog and drink hot cocoa by our very plump Christmas tree, which I've been getting lots of pictures of from my parents, and just be in a place of familiarity and loveliness. So because I'm going home so soon, I've been thinking many homeward thoughts, and it's gotten me thinking about what home is and how thankful I am for it. And it's something that I have thought about a lot because for me, home has been both one of the mainstays of my life. It's been one of the most rooted things, but it's also been one of the greatest ambiguities in my life. For me, that's because my family moved a great deal. So we all kind of disagree over the number because we've counted so many times, but as a family, we think we moved somewhere between 15 and 17 times and 6 times internationally. And growing up, the longest we ever lived somewhere, like in one state, was for 4 years until we moved to Colorado. So we moved a great deal. And so while home, you know, which to me was my family and sometimes is represented by the things in my home that I loved and the things, the couches, the people, home was not a place for me. It was moving from place to place. And so I felt very secure in my family, but there was also always this kind of presiding question of what is home? And that's only been exacerbated as I have gotten older. And, in my early 20s, I was just counting today, and over the last 5 years, I have moved 8 times and 2 times internationally, and I thought, my goodness, I'm really continuing the legacy of my family. And as I've moved around and tried to form life in places, it's really come back to me again and again, the question of what is home? And that happens every time I go home, too, because I don't know if any of you all have had this experience, but there's this experience of going back to the place you call home when you've had your adventures and traveled all around and thinking, will I still belong there when I get back? Will people have changed? Will I have changed? And that brings back this question of what is home? Where is home? And how do I get there? So I've been thinking on that this week, and it struck me that in many ways, the search for home or the journey home is the oldest story. I was thinking about the Odyssey, which is a whole story about Odysseus and his journey home after this defeat in Troy. And the whole story is about him journeying and trying to get back to home and wondering if home will be the same. And so I was thinking about that. That's one of the oldest stories we have, is a story of wanting to journey home. And then I was thinking about how one of the oldest griefs is being exiled. We see this over and over again, whether it's in ancient histories or in the history of Israel, where you have this whole kind of over and over again in the Old Testament, there's this theme of being exiled and longing to go back to home. Or even I was thinking about The Lord of the Rings, which, you know, if you've read it, it's narrated by Bilbo and Frodo. It kind of switches back and forth, the story, although very hiddenly, you wouldn't know it. And the title that Bilbo gives the story is There and Back Again, so, which is to say that it begins in Hobbiton and it ends in Hobbiton. And there's a sense that the whole story is about leaving home and learning to come back. And I just kept on thinking about that with this T.S. Eliot poem, that the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And I don't know where all of you all are at in life, if you are journeying home or somewhere like home or somewhere that doesn't feel like home for Christmas or the holidays, or if you're in the midst of making a home, making traditions, making a place for the people you love. But I just thought this is a worthy thing to discuss because I think that the longing for home, the feeling of exile and the desire to belong somewhere is deep and well testified in the experience of humanity. So today, I want to ask this question. Where is home? And in keeping with our ordinary episodes, we'll be looking at this through the eyes of three artists. So let me give you a preview of what those will be, and I'll give you my preview answers to where is home. The first is that home is where you belong, and we'll be looking at Elizabeth Googe and her novel, The Pilgrim's Inn. The second answer is that home is where life happens, and we'll be looking at the paintings of the Dutch Golden Age painter Vermeer. And then finally, the third answer will be that home is where there is hope, and we'll be looking at the African-American spirituals and then also the New World Symphony by Dvorak. I just have to tell you all that I loved doing the research for this week. These are three, well, four actually, kind of pieces and things that I'm really excited about, and I'm excited to share them with you. And they were really moving to me to study, too. So before we dive in, I would love to ask you that if you enjoy this podcast, that you would go subscribe on iTunes, leave a review and a rating, and tell a friend. So with that aside, let's dive into this week's pieces. So the first one we'll be looking at is our literary example, and that is Pilgrim's Inn by Elizabeth Googe. Elizabeth Googe was an English novelist who lived from 1900 to 1984. She is such an interesting character. I just love her. It's odd because when you find people that know her, they like love her. And she was really well known and sold really well. And there was an abundance of people that really enjoyed her novels contemporarily in her era. But then I find that not as many people know about her as they should. Something that's cool about her is that she's in public domain, so you can get a lot of her books for free online. So look that up. Take advantage of that. She was the daughter of kind of a prominent churchman, and so he was the dean of Ely Cathedral, which is this incredible, huge Saxon cathedral in Cambridge, and then he worked in various places in Oxford and Cambridge, and so she kind of grew up ensconced in this very odd world of kind of being amongst the best and the brightest, but also kind of having the humble life of a church family that didn't have tons of money, but that also got to be in these incredibly beautiful places. And she has a broad array of novels and short stories. I read her autobiography recently. It's really beautiful. And her work kind of focuses mostly not on huge plots, but on human dramas and the life of ordinary people and families. But the thing that she is amazing at is she is just incredibly, like, incisively insightful into human psychology and desires and hopes and fears, and almost unlike anyone I've ever read. So I really recommend her. And this is nowhere more true than in Pilgrim's Inn, which is, I think it's the second in the Elliot family series. And my mom and I actually, when I was so in between university and then doing my master's, I lived back in Colorado at home for a little while I saved up money. And my mom and I read this book out loud to each other while I was home that spring, and it snowed a lot, so we got snowed in, and we would just read this out loud, and it was just a really precious, happy memory to me. But the book it's shaped around this family, the Elliot family, and at the time, the opening of the book, it's after they've all kind of been undone in various ways by World War II. So, you know, you've got the family that was in and out of London. There's kind of like a bigger family that has, I think it's three kids. I can't remember off the top of my head. But they have kind of, they had to move in and out of London because of the war. And then you have this guy, David, who's an actor, but then was a pilot, and he lost a lot of friends, and he has kind of what we would call PTSD, although I don't think at that point they had that language. And so it's kind of, it starts off with this family, and you kind of see all of them have these various issues and struggles they're going through in a kind of isolated way, like they don't think anybody else can deal with it. So you have David, like I said, the depressed, post-traumatic kind of, is there any meaning in the world and is there a God actor, who is also plagued by the fact that he just barely escaped having an affair with his, I think it's his cousin's wife, which is a thing that you should not do, obviously. And he knows that, so he doesn't. But he really loved her, and she really loved him. And so he is kind of like, he's this interesting character because on the one hand, you know how incredibly privileged he is. You know, he survived the war. He's a successful actor. But he feels like all the things of meaning have been taken out of his life, and he's kind of mopey. with good and bad reason. And then there's Nadine, who is the unhappy mother of her children, and she's just kind of never settled into that role, and she's bored with her husband, and he is hurt by her boredom. And then you've got George, who is the husband of Nadine. Also, Nadine and George are the couple that David almost broke up but didn't. And George is just kind of like a good old guy who's trying to bring some normalcy to his family, and struggling because he can't, you know, after the war and after trying to do this. So as a big move, George is like, what if we move to the country? That seems like that would be a great normalizing thing for our family after the World War. We can all get some sea air and be in the country. Nadine hates this idea because Nadine is like a beauty queen socialite. And she thinks everything is wrong with this idea. But here is where the story begins. So as you can see, this story is about various people kind of sharing their own burdens, not sharing their own burdens, feeling very alone in them, and also having this kind of, they will never be solved and they'll never be fixed. So as the whole book kind of takes place around these two homes, and the homes, particularly the one home, which is called Damerose, they are almost characters in themselves. Like there's this kind of this sense in the way that she writes it, that the homes like have will and make decisions and agency. And part of that is directed by this kind of the matriarch of the Elliot family who looks on all of her children. She looks on George, and then she's got several other children. Like there's a parson in the family, and she sees that they're kind of floundering, and she gets it into her head that she wants to kind of help them move towards wholeness. So through a series of events, all of these kind of troubled characters end up being brought out to the country, and this whole like plot unfolds around Damerose, this home. And it's there that they end up kind of experiencing individually their redemptions in very different ways. And it's not easy. And that's what's so beautiful about how Elizabeth Gooch writes, is that it's not like a, and then they went there and they were like, oh, the fresh air, now I feel better and I don't want to have an affair and everything is better. And that's really like a very small part of the book, but you know, read it. It's the sense of there's something about this home and being in this home that makes them be able to work through their issues and feel like they can move towards wholeness. And so I was thinking about, what is it about that home? What is it that Elizabeth Gooch is trying to say about Damerose that could tell us something about where home is or what it is? And as I was thinking about it, my first inclination was to say, oh, well, it's a safe place, right? And I do think that there's a truth to that, that home is a safe place. And that's, you know, a theme that she goes back through over and over again, because it's right after World War II. And so there's a sense of, we are safe here. This can't be blown up by a bomb. This is a good place. But I was thinking that that's true, but safety is not all that a home is, because I could be safe in a closet. I could be safe in a metal box. Safety is just one element of home, and it's certainly not the element that I think really brings them all to fullness, because you could be safe alone and still have all the burdens of your brokenness and your issues, and they all could in the characters in the story. So I think that what really makes the difference in this story is that home is where they belong and where they are known and where they are held and being known. That's something that is like a theme throughout the book, is that all these people who kind of carry their burdens in this, like, oh, I have my burden and no one else will know about it, they're almost teased out of it throughout the story. They are forced to be seen. And in being seen, they're able to share their burdens. And in sharing their burdens and not being unrealistic about them, they're accepted and taken care of there. And they begin to unfold their wounds and their longings of their hearts, and they begin to heal and love one another. And to me, that is such a beautiful example of what home is and what home has been for me. Home is the place where you belong, and in that belonging, you are safe. And that helps you be able to work through your issues and your thoughts and your troubles. And it's there that Damerose does its magic, and that you begin to see people move towards wholeness. And it's something I've thought about a lot, and we've actually talked about a lot in my family. When we got my dog, Darcy, a couple years ago, my mom got her because it had been kind of a hard year, and it was coming up on Christmas, and various members of us were kind of gloomy. And my mom, being the amazing woman that she is, was like, we need something to distract us and something to love. We're going to get a dog. And so we found this litter that I think it was like a breeder, but they hadn't meant to have this litter. And so we thought, perfect, there's still puppies available. We went to go pick them. And I remember when we went, it was so fun. I mean, there's literally nothing better than like sitting in a room full of puppies that are like tumbling over each other and being able to pet puppies. But I remember we were talking about it later because the breeder had told us that, you know, the dogs get really attached to their pack. So that when you bring them home, you need to make them feel like you are their pack, or else they'll kind of get insecure and afraid and they'll bark a lot. And my mom and I laughed about that. And she was like, I think that our family, we are each other's pack. And there's this sense of once you belong to us, once we belong to each other, there's no getting out. We'll always belong to each other. We are each other's pack. We can go back to that. And there's that place of security and belonging that means that we're never isolated and alone and that we can always feel safe. Not just safe in body, but safe in relationship to work out our troubles and our issues. And I think that that is something that Elizabeth Gouge does so well of showing, is that when you are safe in belonging, you can work out your issues and talk about the deep longings and issues of your heart in a place of safety that moves you towards healing, and that you can mutually fill each other. And that's something that's difficult, and it's something that when you're with a whole bunch of fallen human beings doesn't always work. And I think the fact that we all want that so very much means that when we don't experience that belonging, it's particularly hurtful. But I think that's part of why something else that Elizabeth Gouge does well is she talks about how that belonging isn't just in your family, you know, the brothers and sisters and parents that you've been given, but that belonging can also come from kind of the way that we adopt people as friends. We will adopt people into our home. So that was just a beauty for me of Pilgrim's Inn, is that it is about a place, but the home is also, and I think more essentially, it is about belonging to other people. And that belonging also comes with the fact that that home belongs to you, that you have something worthwhile in your life. And that's something that she talks about also, is that feeling of both belonging to a place and to people, but then also be able to have a place and a people that belong to you, gives you something to work and to fight for. Gives you something worthwhile. And she has this quote that I just really love where she says, "There were still children in the world, and while there were children, men and women would not abandon the struggle to make safe homes to put them in. And while they struggled, there was hope." And I thought that's one of the beauties of home. You know, while we still want to struggle for this place to belong and place to be safe, there's always hope in that. So the first way to think about this is that home is the place where you belong and the place that belongs to you. It's really great. You should read it. Okay, so the second answer, and this we're moving into our visual depictions, is perhaps the more kind of obvious answer to where is home. And that is, home is where life takes place. And my addendum to that, which I'll talk about, is that where life takes place, that life that does take place is meaningful and valuable and more meaningful than we could even know. So our example for this and our artwork we're going to look into is Vermeer, Johannes Vermeer. He lived from 1632 to 1675. Pardon me while I take a sip of tea. So Vermeer was really only moderately successful in his life. He was kind of well known, but like not super well known. When he died, he left his wife and children in deep debt, so he wasn't super famous. And then after he died, he just kind of faded into obscurity. People didn't know about him at all. In retrospect, now we think of him as one of the greatest painters of the Dutch Golden Age. And it's kind of amazing what a reputation he has for how few paintings we have by him. So Vermeer is known for paintings of kind of just ordinary life. A Vermeer scholar writes that almost all of Vermeer's paintings are apparently set in two smallish rooms in his house in Delft, and they show the same furniture and decorations and various arrangements, and they often portray the same people, mostly women. So I just think this is so interesting. Vermeer is known to be one of the great painters, but all of his paintings basically take place in two rooms with people doing things like making bread, using milk, doing their studies. It's just very ordinary things, and yet he's considered one of the greatest masters of that age. Now, something that is significant about Vermeer and what he's probably more known for is his use of light. So I've put a couple of these up in the blog post, but Vermeer's paintings are just like transcendent in the way he uses light to cast on these moments. And what I love about that is that he makes these really ordinary moments kind of like shimmer with this sense of meaning and of kind of like, oh, there's something beneath these ordinary moments happening. And I think that that to me speaks to, again, what home is. So for us, we see Vermeer is very much this artist who kind of represents home in the sense of most of his paintings take place in his home. They're simple, they're ordinary, they're doing normal little tasks. They are kind of mundane. Even he as a person, you know, was not super well known. He wasn't flashy or known in the future. He was just kind of an ordinary guy with a whole bunch of children. And to me, that's very much like most of our experience of home. It's not something flashy. It's something ordinary. It's something everyday. And when we say, where is home? Home is where most of life happens. But something else that Vermeer teaches us, I think, through his use of light, is that those ordinary and mundane moments of life, of making bread, of doing our studies, of sitting with our families, can be moments of shimmering meaning. And he kind of shows with his use of light the glory of the ordinary. His paintings speak to this and remind us that this ordinary experience of life, you know, that life is, that home is where life happens, is not just mundane, or in its mundanity there is meaning. I think that that kind of, to me, speaks to several things. First, that ordinary life of the home speaks to our value for others. So I think it's easy in our very capitalistic, fast-paced, productivity-oriented culture to say, well, yes, we all must live, we must eat, but what is really the meaning of these kind of mundane or ordinary tasks? But for me, I think one of them is that those mundane and ordinary tasks speak to our value for other people. I used to have a mentor, and whenever I'd go to her house, she would sit down and make me a pot of tea, and she always had like a special, I still do this every time I go back to visit her, she'll have a pot of tea and a special treat. And I remember her saying once that kindness speaks value to people. When you take the time not to just make these little ordinary moments rushed and go past, but you take time for details, it speaks to your value for the person that you prepared for them. One thing I always have loved in the Gospels is that Jesus says, I go to prepare a place for you. And then he talks very mundanely about a house with rooms. In the sense of home is where you're prepared a place for, and that speaks of your value and of the value of the people who come into your home. I think also Vermeer teaches us that these moments of just little ordinary moments speak to the value of things other than just productivity, the value of kind of the pulsing life of the home, that it kind of has its own character. And I think about that with Damerose and Pilgrim's Inn too. There's this kind of underlying ethos of, oh, that's Joel reminding me to pay rent. I will do that after this. There's this underlying ethos in a home that its life sustains and gives back to everyone else, that's totally outside of the world of productivity and keeping going and accomplishing things, but that is still completely and beautifully valuable and worth it. And the third thing that I think Vermeer reminds me of is that there can be this kind of sacramental presence in ordinary life. Now, let me describe what I mean by that. So usually when we say things, when we call something sacramental, that can refer to like the sacraments, which are things in church where God is specifically present with us, like baptism or taking the Eucharist. But sacramental can also mean that there are things in life where we experience kind of a charged presence of God's presence with us and meaning in the world. And I think that Vermeer reminds us that ordinary life can be those places where we experience the closeness and presence and meaning of God in our lives. And it reminds me of, you know, the verse we've all heard a million times, but whatever you do, be it eating or drinking, do it all to the glory of God. And there's a sense that these little ordinary moments of life, the things that make us human, the home that gives life to everyone else, these are for glory. They are purposeful and they are meaningful just in being themselves. And there's a beauty to ordinary life. So I love that Vermeer teaches us that with the way he uses light to kind of illuminate these ordinary moments. And something that I like to think of when, because I can wax eloquent about this, but I hate doing dishes as much as the next guy. And something that I like to think about sometimes is I like to imagine when I'm doing ordinary tasks at home that Vermeer is painting me with transcendent light flowing over me. So if you are struggling to feel like your ordinary life moments and cooking and cleaning and loving the people in your home is worthwhile, I would just encourage you to imagine Vermeer painting you. And if you could see yourself in that light, you would see just how beautiful the ordinary moments are. So that is Vermeer. He teaches us that home is where life happens and that that life is meaningful and worthwhile. The final thing, the final answer to me for this week, of course, there's much more that could be said, is that home is where there is hope. So I've been talking a lot about, in these last 2 points, you know, about the kind of the good experiences of home, you know, of that it's where we belong to, and that it's where ordinary life happens, and that it's good and meaningful. But I think that many of us have had an experience of feeling like we didn't have a home, or like we were cast out of our home or exiled from our home. And maybe even more of us have had that experience. And that home is something that is something we long for, but don't totally know how to experience. And I think that that in itself, and the ache that we feel in those moments where we don't feel like we belong or we don't feel like we have a home, is actually a testimony to the power of home, the power of the desire we have for home. And I think the exile is about as common of an experience of a desire or a sadness as the desire and love of home. And there could be nothing more revealing to me than this, this idea of longing for home and the experience of exile than in my country, the sadness of the history that we have with slavery. And that kind of leaves us into our next example, which is the African-American spirituals. So, you know, this sad part of the history of America, this really upsetting part, you had this whole group of people who were just totally ripped up out of their homeland and taken to a new place where there were different traditions, different experiences of home than you'd ever have before. And that created this real sense of exile, of longing to go back. But then in this, it's, you know, it's that same experience of, if you could go back, would it be the same? Would they be able to have the same lands, the same places? And something that happened with a lot of the slaves in the early years in America was that they were oftentimes forced to convert, or at least to attend Christian services. And this was kind of with the idea of like, oh, well, it will calm them down and they'll all be very virtuous and that will be good. I'm not saying that's always the idea, but that was often the idea. And I thought it would kind of make people behave and be satisfied and, you know, all this. But what was the unintended consequence was that a lot of these communities started hearing the stories of Moses, you know, and about the slaves of Israel being led out of Egypt. And naturally, they started to be like, this is our story. This is our plight. And God cares about our plight. And it's really cool when you start doing the research, like kind of the history of these spirituals. But so they started looking at church actually as a place to long for and pray for release from exile and release to a home. And particularly like in the era of the Great Awakening, not one of the Great Awakenings, there was this movement kind of where a whole bunch of preachers and stuff started to be against slavery and, you know, for abolition. And so they would go and they'd preach, and then people started developing these songs, not like out of kind of, it was kind of in the tradition of hymns, but more really owned by the slaves at those times, kind of adopting their own narrative of longing for freedom and longing for home, and creating these beautiful tradition of what we know now as the African American spirituals. And one of the most common themes when you listen to these songs, because they've been preserved and they're just so beautiful, is this theme of going home, this theme of desiring to go back to the place that they belonged. And that comes a lot, again, with the idea of the Israelites longing for a new place, you know, to be released from Egypt, to go back to their homes. And with the whole idea of exile in the Old Testament. And, you know, you could think about examples of this would be like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, or Coming For to Carry Me Home. Or there's ones about, you know, I'm going home to be with Jesus, or I'm going home to be with my mother. And so home began to represent both this like release from exile, this release from slavery into freedom, into a place where they could belong, but also to a heavenly home in the sense of, I don't know if I'll ever belong here. I'm just going to play you this clip from a YouTube clip I found of these guys. I think they're all in college, incredibly talented. And they did a medley. I have this on the blog of some kind of examples of the spirituals. I think it's absolutely beautiful. And just kind of listen for that sense of wanting to go home and that being a theme. Okay, you have to go listen to the rest of it. It's just absolutely beautiful and passionate and interesting. But that's just an example of some of the many spirituals that came out of that era, and that they're all kind of centered around this experience of being of slavery, of being taken away from your home, of being enslaved and longing for both the home that you came from, but also just a heavenly home, a place where there's no longer any being entrapped. And this became, I mean, this is like one of the, it's funny when you think about what are uniquely American kind of forms of art. This is uniquely American. This comes out of nowhere except for North America. And I just think it's beautiful. You should definitely look it up. So someone who was captured by this whole kind of the melodies, the harmonics, and the themes of this was a composer named Dvorak. Now, Dvorak was a, I think he was, he's a Czech composer. That's right. My first inclination was correct. He's a Czech composer, and he's most famous for his piece, which we're going to talk about, which is the New World Symphony. And he had been kind of successful in Europe, but he had also had some experiences of people kind of being prejudice against his background, being Czech. And so he was offered this commission to come to work at a school, which would actually transform and eventually become what Juilliard is today. And in his time there, he took on this project to write a symphony for America. And it was going to be called the New World Symphony. And his goal was to kind of capture the ethos of America. And in his time there, he befriended this guy named Harry Burley, who actually became one of the first classical composers who was African-American, who's black, and was an incredible singer. He was known for his baritone voice. And Burley introduced him to spirituals, and he sang him Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and all these different famous spirituals, and Dvorak just fell in love with it. And so when he came to write this piece, the New World Symphony, which was supposed to kind of characterize America, get at the ethos of America, Dvorak said, I was inspired by two things. He said, the songs of the Native Americans and the songs of the spirituals that came out of the South and slavery. And so Dvorak, as he composed the New World Symphony, said, these are the things that are going to characterize America. And when you listen to it, the symphony, the whole kind of idea behind it is, what do people see when they're coming towards America? And why do people like Dvorak, who is Czech? You know, what are they hoping for when they come to America and to this new world? And one of the most famous sequences from it, which is what I'm going to end today with, is this beautiful melody that he composed, which later on Burley composed a actual, like a libretto to, called Coming Home or Going Home. And I think it's so interesting because he compares these two ideas of the new world, but also with going home, that you're going to a new place, place of opportunity, of hope. But then also that in going to a new place, you're hoping that new place will be the place with hope, and therefore it'll be home. And I think it's so significant that he said very strongly, like, I think that the future of American composition lies in the tradition of the spiritual and of the Native American music, which is just so interesting. And both of those being people whose home had been disrupted and exiled and had this kind of, I mean, it was totally, in some ways, ruined by America. And yet that would be what he would identify as kind of the hope and the vision for how can we begin towards healing and towards home. For all these people who are coming to America with hope, it's in these narratives of longing for home and longing for a place of hope. And I heard this piece has always been really special to me because I heard it when I was 15 years old. My mom took me on a trip when I was 15 years old to go back to where she lived in her 20s in Vienna. And she took me to this concert at the Musikverein, which is his favorite, very famous concert hall. And we heard this piece, Dvorak, by Dvorak. And, you know, in retrospect, I'm kind of frustrated with my 15-year-old self because I don't think I nearly appreciated everything as much as I should have. But when I heard this piece, it took me by the shoulders and shook me. It was so beautiful and moving to me, even in my little young, angsty years. And what I heard in it, to me, like when you think about what you feel and what you see when you listen to this piece, was I heard this tentative hope for home, this tentative hope for the place that you are going to be a place of peace and of rest and of hope. And it just moved me. I can still remember, like if I close my eyes, I can still see the music frying and remember how I was feeling. But I think that gets back to, again, the answer of where is home? Home is the place that we can learn to hope. And home is the place we hope for. I've always thought it was beautiful and significant that in the prophecies of like Isaiah, you have these huge visionary things and kind of apocalyptic. But then they always kind of come back to these prophecies of, like in Isaiah 65, it comes back very simply to this phrase of in those days, in the future when everything's made right, in those days, people will live in the homes they build and eat the fruit of their own vineyards. And to me, that is the hope that home holds for us in our hearts. It's the hope of a place of peace, of belonging that we can't quite experience yet, but that we have this sense of longing for, and that gives us hope to want to keep living and want to keep hoping for that. So I wanted to end today by playing you that movement from Dvorak's New World Symphony, the movement which was later composed by Burley to be Coming Home. I think it's beautiful, and as I prepare to go back home, I hope that you too will have a place that you can go where you know that you belong, where you know that life is meaningful and good, and where you can experience hope. So much love, and I will talk to you all soon.
Thank you.